The thesis of this ongoing shiur, that the parsha is a cohesive unit, an integrated piece of divine art, which weaves together as a tapestry when we develop the text methodically, well, is easy this week. Parshas Vayetze is so clearly a cohesive unit. The parsha begins with Yaakov's frightful escape from his brother Esav, who seeks to kill him. And then Yaakov, so to speak, jumps from the frying pan into the fire because he spends time in Laban's house, Laban who seeks to cheat him and persecute him further. So this is Yaakov's flight and exile story. And then the parsha ends with Yaakov escaping Laban unharmed and the beginning of his trek back to Eretz Yisrael, back to the Holy Land. So it's clearly the story of Yaakov's exile and exile troubles, as magnificently connoted by the name of the parsha, Vayetze, which means, and he left. Yaakov left. Yaakov left Eretz Yisrael, the Holy Land. Yaakov left his place of security. He has left. He is now vulnerable. And Parshas Vayetze as a whole, from this perspective, really holds the promise to be developed in a very meaningful way for all of us who face the Vayetze dynamic, when we must leave positions of comfort. Certainly, life does not allow us to remain in comfortable positions, but we struggle. We're thrown into new situations, unexpected situations, and yes, even trying situations. And yes, we are in exile right now as a nation. So Vayetze is promising and encouraging. Let's see if we can sink our teeth into Vayetze and make gold out of it from this perspective. So step one in developing any parasha as a whole is to find our bookends, how the beginning and the end of the parasha are bookended symmetrically. And again, in Parashas Vayetze, it's quite easy. The text does this for us, because Parashas Vayetze begins with a prophecy. Yaakov is promised by Hashem. Hashem promises Yaakov that he will protect him throughout his troubles. And this prophecy is set against the backdrop of the Jacob's ladder scene. Yaakov dreams, and there is a ladder reaching from earth to heaven, and v'hinei malchei elokim olim b'yardim bo. Angels are going up and down the ladder. So you see how the parasha begins with angels, and it ends with angels, with malachim. At the end of the parasha, as Yaakov's trekking back to the Holy Land, it says, v'yaakov holch l'darku, Yaakov goes on his way, having escaped Laban, v'yifku bo malachei elokim. And he is encountered by Malachim. And it ends, therefore, Vayikra Shem HaMakom Ahu Machanayim. He called it camps because of the two camps of angels he encountered. Don't you see it right there in the text? The parasha begins with angels in the vision of the latter story, and it ends with angels as Yaakov's tracking back. It's so clear there's something to angels here. What do the angels represent, both in the beginning of the parasha and the end of the parasha? So the Medrash develops the angels in the beginning of the parasha for us. The Medrash explains that Malachim, angels, are a protective force when one is traveling, when one has left their place of comfort. Because the Pasuk says, Ki Malachav Yitzavolach Lishmarcha B'chol Drachecha. Hashem has sent his angels to protect you on your travels. In other words, angels are a depiction of a divine intervention, a force of hashgacha from Hashem, in this case to protect us when we are vulnerable. So Yaakov is on the road. Yaakov is in exile throughout our parasha. So therefore we begin to understand, as we develop this medrash, the parasha is bookended by angels, i.e. protective angels, a depiction of Hashem's protection, Hashem's the succor Hashem provides Yaakov, a palpable sense that Hashem is with him throughout of his travels. This is what the parasha begins with. This is what our parasha ends with, because this is really the big theme of the parasha: succor amidst struggle, amidst exile. And if we develop a bit further, we appreciate why Hashem, in the opening to the parasha, showed him not only angels, but the ladder upon which the angels ascend and descend, as though Hashem wanted him to have a physical imagery of the linkage between heaven and earth, that angels, a divine force from heaven, travels directly down to earth. It was important for Yaakov to see this connectivity between heaven and earth, because Yaakov here feels abandoned here on earth. He's been exiled. He's running for his life. And then he's going to face Lavan, Mr. Double Cheat. Yaakov could easily feel abandoned, as though there's this great gap between him and the heavens. Where is Hashem in my life, the way I'm suffering? Does this sound familiar? As we face down struggles. So it's so important for him to see these angels in their descent from earth to heaven, that there is this direct line as reflected by the ladder. This is the direct line of divine intervention. We are never disconnected from the highest spheres as much as we might be in the bottom pits. This is the ladder of connection upon which the angels as though descend. That is the physical imagery which Yaakov sees in the dream. So those are the angels in the beginning of the parasha. And likewise, the angels at the end of the parasha. Yaakov is leaving exile and he sees once again angels. It's been clear to him it's this force of divine protection which has protected him throughout. Beautiful, clear, crisp. The book ends of the parasha, the angels in the beginning, the angels in the end, and what this represents is a parasha of Vayetze, a missed divine protection. And we see one added layer to this symmetry between the two bookends in the beginning and the end of the parasha from a commentary of Rashi. Rashi tells us that the angels in the beginning of the parasha, you notice, are two groups. It says Olim, some angels are going up the ladder, V'yardim, and some angels are going down the ladder. And Rashi explains this is because there are two types of angels. There are angels of Eretz Yisrael, angels of the land of Israel, and angels of Chutz La'aretz, angels of outside the land of Israel. And let's appreciate Rashi's words meaningfully. What does it mean there are angels of the land of Israel and angels outside the land of Israel? If angels are the expression of divine intervention, what he is saying is there's a different sort of divine intervention in Eretz Yisrael and in Chutz La'aretz, inside the land and outside the land. Of course, there's a much more overt expression of Hashem's presence in the land of Eretz Yisrael, as the Torah frequently tells us. But Yaakov is told nonetheless, although you're leaving the Holy Land here, and you don't have that palpable sense of Hashem in your life, don't think you are abandoned. There is a level of divine intervention outside the land of Israel as well. This is what we Jews have with Hashem, wherever we may be. Place is ultimately not a severing factor. Hashem is with us wherever we are. You have angels outside the land of Israel, so although there are angels going up the ladder, ascending the ladder, leaving you in the land of Israel, you're losing a degree of overt relationship to Hashem. Well, realize Hashem is still with you in another form. You can find Hashem in other forms outside the land of Israel. These are the malachim descending down the ladder. So Rashi explains in the beginning of the parasha. And likewise, Rashi in the end of the parasha explains. When Yaakov leaving the exile and entering Eretz Yisrael faces two camps of angels, as we study. Machanayim, two camps. Rashi explains these two camps are the Malachim of Chutz La'aretz, of outside the land of Israel, who are leaving him, and now the Malachim of Eretz Yisrael, who are escorting him into the Holy Land. That you see quite clearly, Rashi, when we put his two above-cited commentaries together, is seeing these two passages as sandwiching passages, a changing of the guard in the beginning when Yaakov is leaving Eretz Yisrael. The angels of the land of Israel are leaving and the angels of the diaspora are joining him. And then at the end of the parasha, the opposite happens. He's leaving the diaspora, so the angels of the diaspora are leaving, the angels of the Holy Land entering. Thus a full picture of Vayetze, of leaving, is completed. That Yaakov has left the divine protection of Eretz Yisrael. Yet, he's protected throughout his exile by these angels of Chutz La'aretz. And then at the end, he enters safe and secure. The story comes full circle. He's back in the bosom of divine protection of the land of Israel, having survived the lion's mouth, the exile experience of Esau's pursuit and Laban. In the diaspora, now the story comes full circle. He is back in the Holy Land under the overt divine protection of the Holy Land, because even outside of the land of Israel, he had the protective force of this angel. It's very clear what our parasha is about, and it's beginning to shape up in an inspiring way that the parasha is itself oriented. This is a parasha about divine protection, even as we leave the land of Israel, which I would broaden to mean even after we leave desirable spiritual circumstances, a Jew finds himself feeling distant, whether geographically or otherwise, behaviorally from Hashem. Well, you might not feel Hashem the way you did in your holy land, in your spiritual high point, but there is always some form of protection from Hashem wherever a Jew finds himself. You can find Hashem if you open your eyes, as Yaakov did when he saw these angels. A Jew could find Hashem wherever he's at, even amidst struggle in a God-forsaken circumstances. That is what the bookends of our parasha are contouring for us. And the truth is, the evidence of this motif, the protective angel motif, goes beyond the bookends, but lays in the middle of the parasha as well. In the heat of Yaakov's struggle of exile, we see an angel of Hashem appearing once again in an unmistakable deja vu. Have a look. This pasuk is describing Yaakov's difficult time when he was a shepherd for Laban. Laban keeps cheating him out of his wages for shepherding the sheep. But Yaakov says, you know, I had a dream, and I saw Malach Elokim, I saw an angel from Hashem who reassured me that it's all going to work and showed me how Hashem was ensuring that I would, in fact, achieve material success despite Laban's best efforts. I would see the fruits of my endeavors. The sheep that belonged to Yaakov would in fact bear viable progeny, and Yaakov would be a success. Do you not appreciate how this verse that we so often read right over in the middle of the Yaakov story, that he saw Malach from Hashem in his dreams saying, I will protect you, now radiates with meaning? I know what this Malach Elokim is all about. I know what this angel is all about. Yeah, our parasha is all about angels from Hashem protecting. And that's what we traced in the beginning. That's what we traced at the end. Well, of course, right here in the middle, in the heat of the struggle, yeah, there's an angel from Hashem protecting him. This angel's not an isolated angel. It's the far reach of the original angel vision, which he saw in the beginning. Yeah, it all comes together as a splendid pattern in our parasha. Beginning, end, and now here in the middle, he's protected by angels representing that spirit of Hashem, that divine intervention, which we can always, always find if we only open our eyes, even in the depth of galus, the depth of pain. You see, it's right there. Our parasha has done the work for us in terms of weaving the cohesive tapestry for us. And I would suggest there's one more really delicious clue to the way we've read not only Parshas Vayetzeh, but the Yaakov story. Yaakov the person, who we know Yaakov was the patriarch who suffered throughout his life. He models the story of the wandering Jew, the Jew in exile. But our Parsha is telling us that the Yaakov finds angels and everything angels represents. He finds divine protection in his life. Well, now do you not appreciate with so much deeper resonance and depth a pasuk which we all know, when Yaakov at the end of his life tells his grandchildren Ephraim, Hamalach, his grandchildren Ephraim and Menashe, Hamalach hagoalosimi kol ra, the angel who redeemed me from all evil, Yevarech es hana aram, should bless you lads as well, should bless the Jewish children as well. That Yaakov speaks of the angel who protected him, who redeemed him from trouble. What is he referring to? Well, now it's so clear what he's referring to. That Yaakov's entire life experience, especially the experience in our parasha when he suffered, well, he found an angel of protection. He found a divine intervention. And this Parshas Vayetzeh salvation is an eternal bequest to all Jewish children. That Malach, this angel who protected him throughout Parshas Vayetzeh, will continue to protect the Jewish people throughout our suffering. So Parshas Vayetzeh is not only cohesive, but it promises really a continued promise for subsequent Jewish children as comes together in that unmistakable sister passage now in relationship to our parsha, HaMalach HaGol Osi Mikol Ra. Yaakov speaks to the angels who protected him from all evil. This is really beautiful. And I would like to find one more continuous thread laced throughout our parsha. Perhaps we will find an object which keeps reappearing, a thing which keeps reappearing throughout our parsha. Let me explain what I mean. There's a literary device in mundane literature. We don't need to talk about Torah in this regard. That you'll have an author of a play or a script who will have a particular object resurfacing throughout the story, which serves a deja vu purpose to remind the audience or the reader, ooh, think back to the last scene. Keep thinking back to that last scene and how it's resurfacing here, right? Think about a script which will have a fiddler keep reappearing in the different scenes to bring together the story, to coalesce around the fiddler motif. Well, Parshas Vayetzeh does the same thing. There is this object, not a fiddler, but there's another object, which keeps resurfacing throughout the parsha, which directs us to the larger idea of finding succor and protection amidst danger. What is the object I'm referring to? Stones or rocks. Amazing to note how many rocks reappear throughout our parsha. In the beginning of the parsha, when Yaakov has his dream with the ladder, we know he encircled his head with protective rocks because he was sleeping outside. And then in the middle of the parsha, when Yaakov arrives in Haran in Mesopotamia, where he's going to spend time with Lavan, we know the first scene he encountered was a well with a rock on top of the well, a rock which he removed from the well to come to the aid of Rachel, who was a shepherd. But here we have another rock. And then at the end of the parasha, when Yaakov is striking a treaty with Lavan, a treaty which promises that Lavan won't harm Yaakov and vice versa, but for our purposes means Yaakov walks away unscathed. Lavan himself has to commit not to harm Yaakov. We have again stones and rocks, because Lavan and Yaakov mark their treaty with a pile of stones called Galed, a testimonial pile of stones. Right? Have you seen three seemingly unrelated scenes in the beginning, middle, and ends of the parasha? Beginning with, again, Yaakov with his prophecy of the ladder with stones around his head, and then in the middle of the parasha when he arrives in Haran Mesopotamia in Lavan's place, and he encounters a well with a rock on top. And then at the end of the parasha, the pile of rocks. Are these rocks not evocative of each other? Are they not suggesting some cohesive thread throughout the parsha? Right? Only one who would read the parsha in a myopic fashion would read these stories as disconnected without appreciating the author of the text wants to do something for me by, in one story, in one Vayetzeh story, continuing to utilize a rock motif. Certainly the divine author with divine intents, Hashem himself in authoring this story, wants to do something with the rocks. Vayetzeh is a rock story. And what do you think rocks represent? Rocks represent endurance. Think about a rock-solid promise, a bedrock. Monuments are built of stone because rocks endure. So rocks represent endurance. And Vayetzeh is a story of endurance, that despite all the trials and travails, Yaakov will survive and ultimately Yaakov will thrive as well. And Yaakov feels the sensation in the beginning of the story when in the wilderness, when he's sleeping and having his first dream, he finds protections with the rocks around his head. The rocks are, of course, physically a very minimal protection, but they symbolize something to Yaakov. I'm going to be able to find protection. The sensation of his head against the rocks, he feels something here. He feels a bedrock of protection and succor around his vulnerable head here. And from that perspective, we appreciate with so much more depth when he sees a rock right upon arriving in Haran, right upon arriving in Lavan's place with all of the dangers, with all the surfacing dangers and fears, but he thinks back to that rock of protection, ultimately of divine protection. Yeah, what I felt back then around my head and the rest of my body, my whole persona will continue to be protected. And then this is confirmed at the end when he's escapes Lavan unscathed, and the treaty of his protection is marked by stones. Beautiful. The stones throughout the parsha. I think the power of this pattern speaks for itself. Not only is a beautiful textual pattern, but a most meaningful one in terms of the sensation. All right, where we're feeling Yaakov on a personal level, in almost a sensory way, as he's feeling these stones. He's feeling stones around his head, and then he's eyeballing the resurfacing of the stones, and then he's experiencing a treaty upon stones. Something very moving here, and really Yaakov seeing Hashem's promise of protection coming full circle throughout his struggles. And I think we can find one final buttressing clue in a pasuk and a verse later, when Yaakov speaks of, at the end of his life, about the protection of his entire family later in Mitzrayim, in the land of Egypt, under Yosef's tutelage, where he uses strange language, seemingly. He says, Misham roa evan Yisrael. From there he shepherded the stone of Yisrael. Yaakov speaks of his family as a stone, as an evan, when they are endangered. Well, that strange reference now just radiates with light and meaning. Yeah, of course, the stone. The stone became a motif in the Yaakov family of protection amidst struggle, protection in Yaakov's original exile, the Vayetze story when he's exiled to Mesopotamia. And this stone, this protection, continues to reverberate in Jewish consciousness, whether in the exile in Egypt, with Yaakov and family are experiencing in the cited pasuk and beyond until this very day. And there's one more dimension to the stone and its meaning, which becomes apparent when we study a commentary of Rashi on that pasuk, that cited pasuk, when Yaakov later speaks about the stone of Yisrael, Misham Ro Avni Yisrael, that Rashi interprets the word stone midrashically as an abbreviation. Evan, stone, stands for Avu Ben, father and son. That both father and son, Yaakov and his children, were protected, were fed by Yosef in Mitzrayim. Now, it might seem strange in that sister reference we traced beyond our parsha, Misham Ro'a Evan Yisrael, the stone of Israel was shepherded. It might just seem strange, Rashi's mnemonic, that the word stone stands for father and son, because both the father Yaakov and the sons were cared for. Yeah, it's a cute abbreviation that the word Evan in Hebrew stone corresponds to Avu Ben, father and son. What is the deeper meaning? What is the connection between a stone, Evan, and father and son? But now we have the key to understand. We said that a stone is not just a physical, inorganic entity, but Evan's stone represents endurance, which is exactly the notion of generational continuity, Avu Ben, that the promise, Judaism, does not last one generation, but continues with the Masorah into the future. The stone is a motif, not only a physical survival of a given generation, but a continuity of a Jewish people, and then as an abbreviation of Avu Ben, which now opens up a whole new dimension of meaning, returning to our parsha, the Vayetze story, Yaakov's exile story, which is characterized by a stone motif, because it is in this Vayetze story that Yaakov fathers almost all of his children, that, believe it or not, 11 of the 12 tribes, 11 of the 12 Shvatim, are born in exile, are born during a period of struggle, which certainly foreshadows what the Jewish story is going to be, that we are going to thrive as a Jewish people through generations despite hellish suffering. Well, this goes back to our origin, that Yaakov fathers basically or almost his entire family in struggle. We thrive in struggle. Well, that is yet another dimension to the stone. Vayetzi is characterized by a stone motif of endurance, survival, connoting as well generational survival. Yeah, that exile and other menacing forces will not threaten our Mesorah and our ability to transmit the heritage beyond, which is a powerful force which defies logic, which defies sociology. Of course, no sociologist can justify the endurance of the Jewish people from generation to generation, and particularly their continued continuity as a Torah people through the generations. It doesn't make any sense because it's a metaphysical, it's a sacrosanct metaphysical force called Jewish continuity. This is the stone which our parasha is highlighting for us. Evan, Avu ben father and son, Yaakov was building a family and continuing through the generations despite the struggles of God. So this is really a beautiful Parshas Vayetze coming to light here. Hopefully we're beginning to internalize it personally as well, how Yaakov's story foreshadows our own story, not only of exile, but I would say more broadly, the personal travails which we all face, and the fact that we can thrive through travail. Now, I will confide in you personally. There was a time when I used to think to myself, well, sooner or later, I'll be in a place where just every life's going to come together. There won't be problems anymore. Life's going to come together, and then I'll be able to achieve great things. But eventually, it became apparent to me that time never comes so long as I'm vertical, living and breathing in this world. It never really comes together. But amidst the chaos, amidst everything not coming together, we thrive and we achieve great things nonetheless. That's the story of the Jewish people born in exile. This is the story of Yaakov and Parshas Vayetze. And I'm going to suggest that now that we have developed a panoramic view of Parshas Vayetze, the big picture perspective, this is the story of Yisrael Bagalus, the Jewish people in exile, we can now read particulars in the parasha and really see ourselves in the story of Yaakov. Yeah, what Yaakov's experiencing, whether on his run from Esav or whether in his difficulties negotiating and the like with Lavan, yeah, that's us. That's our story in Galus with menacing neighbors and antagonists. And let me show you a few examples how it becomes so apparent how Vayetze is such a divine piece of art, so cohesive and all-encompassing in its treatment of the phenomena of the Jewish people in Galus, beginning with Yaakov. Let's start with one of the most common caricatures, negative images of the Jew in exile. In almost every society, what have they said about Jews in exile? They call us conniving, that we kind of beat the system, particularly in financial dealings. We have these ugly, hooked nose images of Shylock images of what a Jew does, pound of flesh, usury, this, that, the other thing. And we, of course, know the whole story. Every stereotype is based in some truth, oftentimes painful truths, that because Jews were persecuted in Galus in exile, the system was stacked against them. I mean, in many societies, there was even a Jewish tax, a taxing and persecuting Jews, discriminating against Jews. In the Pale of Settlements, we know in Russia, Jews were not allowed to own land. They had occupations denied to them and so forth. So, of course, when you have a system stacked against you, you need to be one step ahead. You need to use that Yiddish cup, that conniving Jewish head, and apply that Talmudic brain, that Gemara cup, to run shenanigans. That's a painful phenomenon, but one we understand in light of the Jewish experience. And I must note, parenthetically, there are consequences to this ghost, to this exile psyche of the Jew, looking at rules and systems as something to be beaten and something which I have to work around. There of course becomes a negative aspect, really a sick aspect to the Jewish psyche, that oftentimes when the Jew is in a culture which is not discriminating, the conniving nature remains. And that we see, unfortunately, in terms of some Jews who we all cringe from when they make the news, who are involved, unfortunately, cheating in other affairs. And we appreciate that there is a disconnect there between when the beating the system was in fact necessary and even moral, when one was dealing with a persecuting culture, as the Rishonim tell us, right? Our great authorities tell us that there's no law of respect in government law when it is a Nazi type of regime or the like, one which is persecuting the people, and one has to work around those laws to keep themselves and their family alive. But, you know, that sort of beating the system, carrying over it, certainly in an American context, is very, very sad and sick. But we appreciate, again, how every stereotype is grounded in a reality, and why in painful exile experiences, Jews had to be so, quote-unquote, conniving, really just to break even. Well, do we find all of that drama, the don't Jew me thing, the conniving thing, but we know what's really going on, the Jew is simply protecting himself. Do we find that in our parish in the Yaakov story? And of course, it's all over the place. That Lavan kept cheating Yaakov, hechlef as maskarti asaras monim. Yaakov says he keeps changing the rules on him. And therefore Yaakov does not allow himself to become a doormat and be taken advantage of. Yaakov proactively engages in schemes. Right? So for example, when the agreement was that Yaakov will have the spotted sheep, Yaakov did everything he could to ensure there would be an abundance of spotted sheep and the like. He peeled sticks in front of the water to induce children to be born in such a fashion, as the parasha tells us. Do you appreciate how this is the Yiddish cup at work here, how to beat an oppressive system? And what happens in our parasha? Lavan and family accuse Yaakov of being immoral. They call him a thief, basically. Right? And he's eyed suspiciously by Lavan and family, we're told several times throughout the parasha. This is the story of the Jewish people in exile. It's right here. It's nothing new. Now, parasha Vayetze truly is coming through for us as the story of Yisrael Bagolus, the Jewish people in exile, with that whole beating the system / having to beat a system stacked against him Jewish phenomena. That's one. Let's find another example of a common gullus experience, which we have known through thousands of years, which really can be rooted back to our parsha. And that's the notion of the wandering Jew. And let me explain what I mean by that. The wandering Jew is not simply a depiction of the Jewish people wandering from place to place in exile, but was actually an ancient Christian statement that seeks to deny the Jewish people's chosenness. Right? Seeks to deny that we remain the chosen people, because after all, we're the wandering Jew. We're this despicable, persecuted people. So, I mean, you know, you see God's not with them anymore, right? And that's how, of course, the early Christians sought to solidify their own case, that they, of course, have found grace in God now in place of the Jews of old. Now this notion that our suffering in exile can be a source not only of physical vulnerability, but spiritual vulnerability as well, that our enemies will therefore try to argue, and even we might have somewhat of a complex if we're the chosen people, why is this happening, can also be rooted back to our parasha. Because in the opening narrative of our parasha, when Yaakov is beholding the imagery of the angels on the ladder, and Hashem's promise, I will protect you. Well, Rashi observes, he not only promises Yaakov physical protection, but he tells him, you will make it back to the land, and you, not Esav, are the chosen one. The heritage of Yitzchak is continuing through you. The heritage of Avraham and Yitzchak is continuing through you, Rashi observes in the Pesukim. Hashem is guaranteeing Yaakov on his way out, you are the chosen one. Why? Because the wandering Jew dynamic is at work here. The spiritual vulnerability, that if you are suffering, if you're going into exile, you're running away from Esav. You're abdicating your right to the land. It seems like you've abdicated your chosenness. No, I will ensure you remain the chosen people. And once again, I would suggest the parashas to be read through the ages, that despite our suffering, we have this promise that our chosenness will continue to be validated and validated and validated, with no greater proof than the fact that the enemy nations cannot stop obsessing about us, because they've never been able to forget the truths themselves of the chosenness of the Jewish people, the specialness of the Jewish people, and how we are the indispensable key to inspire morality and a life of meaning for the world at large. So that's yet a second example of a ongoing Gullus phenomena rooted in Parshas Vayetze. And finally, I would like to trace a third, which is a little more positive. And that's the notion that through exposure in the Gullus and the exile to various host nations and cultures, we take something with us from them. That there's no question, Jews in America, for example, we not only find an idiom and a language in American English, but we do something with American culture. We use it in Torah. This becomes the form of our Jewish expression. Jews in Babylonia, Jews in Germany, the same thing. This is an undeniable truth. You look at Jews from different countries and different cultures who serve Hashem differently because of the different culture they were hosted by and reared in. Right? It's not a coincidence that the Yekkas in Germany, the Jews in Germany, took a precision and a diktuk, dedication to mitzvahs when they lived in an organized German culture. Or it's not a coincidence that it was Jews in Hungary living in an Austro-Hungarian empire, which was a culture which appreciated class and pretty things, so those Jews took with them a hither mitzvah and a beauty of mitzvahs. And it's no coincidence that it was Jews in the Ukraine living among warm-blooded peasants, right? That was the culture from which Hasidus, with its passion and love and joy, emerged. This is a very clear phenomenon which can't be denied. And one which actually Kabbalah notes, when the Arizal teaches us that there are these sparks amongst the nations of the world. There are these holy sparks to be picked up by the Jewish people when they're in exile and brought back to Torah and Judaism. This is a common Gullus phenomena. Well, I would like to suggest that that too is in Parshas Vayetze. It can be found in Parshas Vayetze. If Parshas Vayetze is in fact an all-encompassing treatment of the story of the Jewish people in exile. And this might be surprising to you, because of course Parshas Vayetze is a very harsh parsha. Yaakov's suffering in Laban's home. But yet I would like to find this notion that Yaakov is doing something with the culture he finds himself in, the Laban culture. Where do I see that? Let's think for a second about a simple piece of information that we just take for granted and never really think about. And that is, who does Yaakov marry when he's in exile? He marries Leah and Rachel, the daughters of the aggressor. Now, of course, yeah, we know the story. We know the biographical piece of information. Yes, our matriarch, sorry, Moses, Rachel and Leah happened to be Laban's daughter. But do you appreciate that there's an irony going on here? Laban is the persecutor of Yaakov. He might be an uncle, but he's the persecutor of Yaakov. And Yaakov marries his daughters. The daughters of the aggressor become the building block of the Jewish people. Again, if we weren't so familiar with this, the parasha's narrative and these facts, we'd be shaken, we'd be stirred by this realization, by this irony. Something's going on in the fact that Yaakov is wedding the aggressor's daughter and building a Jewish people through the aggressor's daughter. There's something to that. Well, I'm going to suggest what wedding the aggressor's daughter means is Yaakov is finding a way to build a Jewish people through even the aggressor's culture. The daughter of the aggressor represents the Ezer Connect, the helpmate Yaakov's going to find. Yaakov, believe it or not, is going to find a helpmate for himself within the host culture. That while Eleven personally is only an antagonist, not a helpmate, Yaakov finds in Laban's family a helpmate in Rachel and Leah. That we find aspects of helpmate, we find a way to helpmate Torah and helpmate Jewish observance in the appropriate people and the appropriate elements within the culture around us. And of course, this has to be done with discretion, because there's much bathwater with the baby. There is much cesspool in the host culture we do not want to take with us as we cautiously determine which aspects of the host culture could we utilize in Jewish observance. But there is a helpmate there. There is a Rachel and a Leah in the antagonist family and culture of Lavan, which we could utilize. And the host culture becomes the environment. American culture, American English becomes the environment in which American Torah Judaism thrives, as represented by the fact that the woman, the home through which Yaakov thrives, woman building the home and as the nurturer of environment, the woman, the nurturer, comes from the host culture in this story. There's a powerful symbolism there. We find an environment for Torah, even amidst the host culture. We're able to do this, you understand, because despite all the threats of the Gullus experience, we have been promised from the very beginning, Yaakov has been promised from the very beginning, you're going to survive. You are protected by these rocks that keep appearing and what they represent, the bedrock of protection, which is ultimately the divine presence that's represented by the angels who are escorting you. That is what Parshas Vayetze is all about, and hence it becomes an eternal story of how the Jewish people are protected in exile. Again, the parish is coming together for itself. We almost don't need to do much work here. We just need to kind of sit back and let it all soak in. This is almost an easy parish in terms of a quest to find cohesiveness. It does it for itself. But can we find an additional motif? An additional catchy phrase or the like in the parasha, which brings out what Yaakov is finding here in exile, the notion of finding succor and security even amidst exile, which will hopefully, if we find that phrase or word, which I'm convinced is there, it'll hopefully do something for us, that there's some sort of word, concept, something describing our ability to find succor and security amidst the Gullus. I think I found my word. It's an enigmatic phrase right in the beginning of the parasha. In the opening scene, the Jacob's Ladder scene, when Yaakov finds the ladder, experiences the vision of Hashem in the ladder, it of course actually begins with the words, Vayifka b'makom. Yaakov encountered place. Yaakov encountered this place, and he decided he's going to sleep there. Now, what does that mean by Yifka b'makom, he encountered place? Place? What does that mean? Of course, various interpretations are given. Might this mean the special place, the place where the Beis HaMikdash will be built, that is where Yaakov slept, according to one interpretation? Or might the word makom actually be a depiction of Hashem, who's called Makom, place? Yaakov encountered Hashem. He prayed, he davened the Meir of service here as night was approaching. The Chazal, the sages, teach. We have these various interpretations. What is the place that he's meeting or encountering? Is it the Beis HaMikdash, the place of the Beis HaMikdash, or is it Hashem? But those are interpretations. That's not the literal wording of the text. The literal wording of the text is Vayifka b'makom, he encountered place. If we're going to read those words quite literally, what does that mean, Vayifka b'makom, he encountered place? What does place mean? Place. The word place connotes a sense of belonging. I have found place. Space. Think about that term we use today. Safe space. We're looking for safe space in a menacing environment. We're looking for space, a place. Yaakov is encountering makom, place. The concept of finding safe space. The concept of safe space lays so beautifully in the word makom in its etymology, because the grammarians teach us that the word makom place comes from the word mikayim, giving sustenance to, giving kiyum, giving existence to. Space is that which gives us existence. Yaakov is encountering makom. Yaakov is encountering space. Yaakov is encountering the idea that I can find a protective space for myself, even when I'm on the run. And how poignant it is that when Yaakov is leaving place, he's leaving his place, he's leaving his parents' home, he's leaving the nurturing environment of security, he is still finding place. Because place is more than a geographical statement. As we've been seeing throughout our parasha, even when a Jew's in exile, and geographically speaking, the places we reside are quite threatening, we have what to hold on to. We find from within the confidence, the spirit, the connection to Hashem to hold on to give us place. This concept of makom place, safe space, safety itself has many, many manifestations. One manifestation is geographical, that we Jewish people, even in exile, hold on to the cherished memories of our true place, of Yerushalayim, the place of the Beis HaMikdash. And that is one aspect foreplayed here in the Yaakov story. When Yaakov is encountering the place, and that's interpreted to mean the place of the Beis HaMikdash, that here Yaakov on his way out from Eretz Yisrael is having one final rendezvous with the place of the Mikdash. Well, I think the significance is very, very clear that as he's leaving into exile, he's never severing his bonds, the holiest places within Eretz Yisrael. Those places continue to inform his consciousness. Yaakov is buoyed by this memory of his last encounter with the place of the Mikdash. And he can, so to speak, say every year, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, next year in Yerushalayim, as Jews have said throughout their exile. That's one aspect of Makom. There's another aspect of Makom, which is Hashem himself. Yaakov is praying. He's praying to Hashem in his Marv service here, davening Marv here, in the beginning of the Jacob's Ladder story, in the beginning of his vision. Well, he's not simply praying, but praying to Hashem as Makom, as he who provides space. He's finding Hashem to be that great source of space and protection. That ultimately it is our relationship to Hashem which gives us space, which gives us a sense of belonging, that even if one is rejected by the people around them, by the gullus around them, or a person's in gullus when they have not... Gullus by definition means exile. By definition, I'm not in my place. I don't have a sense of belonging. I am not appreciated by the people around me. I am... But, you know, Hashem, the relationship to Hashem, can always provide that sense of makom, of space, wherever a Jew finds himself. And this was represented as per Chazal, as per the sages' teaching, when Yaakov prayed specifically the prayer, the tefillah of Marav, the evening prayer, the prayer when nightfall has taken effect. The surroundings, the environment is dark and gloomy, but still a Jew pulls out his sitter, his or her sitter, and davens Marav and finds Hashem even amidst darkness, even amidst gloominess. The tefillah of Marav, this prayer of Marav, is the ultimate makom, finding a place, finding a sense of safety and belonging even among darkness and gloominess. Whatever time in the day one feels rejected by their society, one feels as gullus, one does not have a sense of belonging, and they're able to find Hashem pulling out their sitter. So hopefully we're beginning to appreciate really the beauty of this, of the expression in the Chumash, when it says, Vayifka b'makom, Yaakov's encountering place. And that is all the Chumash says. Because on the deepest level, what Yaakov really encountering and finding is the notion of safe space, the notion of I can have a sense of belonging wherever I find myself. And then there are various interpretations thereof, whether Yaakov is finding a connection to the holy place, to the Eretz Yisrael, to the place of the Beis HaMikdash, which he can feel connected to and reminisce about and have nostalgia about wherever he's in Gullus, and maintain the hope I will be back next year, or whether it means the ultimate source of succor and protection, the one who gives us a sense of belonging, Hashem, who is that place. Yaakov is praying the Marav service and finding Hashem to be his place despite his surroundings. So I feel so rewarded by this serious serious study in Revelation, what the opening phraseology in our parsha of Vayifka b'malchum Yaakov encountered space means, I think it really wraps up what our parsha as a whole is really all about. Vayetze as a cohesive unit is breaking out for us the truism. We really are insecure. Per se, the place which we find ourselves can at times be menacing, as we said. One is not appreciated, even persecuted at worst. That is the story of life, certainly of this imperfect life living in Galus, until Mashiach comes. And at times a person has a personal Galus, personal exile, even amongst fellow Jews, despite people's best intentions. One so oftentimes is an outlier who's unappreciated by people around them and misunderstood. Have we not all been there? We all have a personal exile. But we can continue to find makom. We can continue to find this sense of belonging, succor, and safety wherever we find ourselves. This is really a very heartening notion. Yeah, that hopefully you not only appreciated in tonight's shiur, the way the text came together in all of its cohesiveness. The book ends in the beginning and the end, Malachim in the beginning, angels in the beginning, Malachim angels at the end, Malach angel in the middle, rocks throughout the parsha and bedrocks of security and references to generational continuity, and all the other tinkerings we did. Hopefully you not only appreciated the textual work, but hopefully the cohesiveness of the parsha comes together in your consciousness and in your heart with one overarching resolute message of encouragement. We can find this makom, we can find the sense of belonging and security. No one can take that away from us. Circumstances can be a challenge, but circumstances ultimately don't determine our reality. Reality comes from within. And for a Jew, that inner reality, that sense of makom, places ultimately in the relationship to Hashem, that which transcends everything else. Vayifka b'makom, we encounter space, we ultimately encounter Hashem, who provides us with a sense of belonging. This is Parshas Vayetze in days of old, and this is Parshas Vayetze as it remains ever relevant today.